trip, because you're going to have to do work.
And Tina. We're going to have a meeting with Tina.
The Joint Committee on Tax Credits for Friday, June 2nd, 2017, will come to order. Thank you all for coming and being on time today. The first order of business is a work session on the adoption of committee rules. Paul, do you want to tell us what we're doing here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The rules that you are adopting are identical to the rules you adopted several weeks ago with the Joint Tax Reform Committee. So,
except we changed the name.
We changed the name, yes. But the, everything else is the same. Easy. And keeping in mind that vote requirements are based on chamber and not, and also a quorum requirements are based on chamber.
Okay. What's your feathers? Co-Chair Hass?
Six. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Move the committee rules.
Oh, I'm sorry. Move the committee rules. Chair Barnhart.
Thank you.
Distracted.
Co-Chair Hass moves the Joint Committee on Tax Credit Committee Rules as printed and before you today. Discussion? Objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Second item, information meeting, tax credit overview.
Chair, I'm going to turn that over to Chris.
Chris. So,
good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenite, Legislative Revenue Office. So I'm just going to go over an overview of the tax credits, and I have a handful of slides here, and I'm going to provide some level of detailed information on the two credits that you have before you. There are four bills, but two credits. One of them is the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit, and the other is the Residential Energy Tax Credit. So to start off with, we have the list of tax credits that made it through the process to JTAX. So there are a total of 10 credits from the expiring list, and that's the top part of the process of this table here. And the revenue impacts here are just those from the beginning of session, and those are just for a simple sunset extension. And the bottom part of the table here are four new tax credits that made it to JTAX from the Senate side. So within here, we see the total revenue impact of these tax credits of simply extending them is about $22 million. For those who have been following, that number is less than a prior number, but that's because the tax credits that didn't make it to JTAX are not on this list. And the columns over here on the right are the relevant House and Senate bills. So the two credits that are before you today are the Residential Energy Tax Credit, 2681 and 177. Senate Bill 177 is just the committee six-year extension. House Bill 2681 has some policy changes. It had some reporting requirements by the Department of Energy in addition to the six-year extension. And then the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit right down here, the Senate Bill 166 is the six-year extension. House Bill 2852 has some significant policy changes in it, and I'll cover those as we get into the slides. But basically, in addition to the six-year sunset, it increases the cap and inserts a new auction tax credit that I'll talk about in a little more detail, and I think you're going to hear about in the hearing. So to dive into the tax credits, the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit, this is one for lenders that make qualified low-interest loans for housing, and the tax credit is a differential in the interest rate. If the market rate for these loans is, say, 5%, the lender can make a loan at 1% or up to 1% so that the spread is 4%, then they are eligible for a credit that equals the difference between those two. And I have an example in a couple of slides. The eligible projects, you have a construction, development, acquisition, and so forth of manufactured dwelling park, basically low-income housing. The loans must be certified by the Housing and Community Services Department. And in current statute, there is a program cap of $17 million. And this is $17 million in outstanding credits for any fiscal year. Now, these credits follow a loan, so they're, for the most part, 20-year tax credits. They're spread out over 20 years. And the cap is kind of a revolving fund type of cap, where in any given fiscal year, the amount of outstanding credits is limited to $17 million. One thing that's unique about this program, it's highlighted in red here, is that the loan recipient the bank, the lender that takes it, that gets to claim the tax credit, the value of that tax credit has to be passed on to in the form of reduced rents for the low-income renters. And that's a little bit unusual from other tax credits, but that's a mechanism that reduces the rents for the low-income people. And the housing department is here, and they can talk about the mechanics or questions that you have about that. As the committee is aware, one of the things we've tried to do with tax credits is assign purpose statements or qualify purpose statements for the tax credits. As the legislature reviews and analyzes the tax credits, it's important to understand what the purpose is of the tax credits. This particular one doesn't have anything written in statute. There's no purpose statement in statute. The implementing legislation in 89 indicated that most of this was in response to a reduction in federal funding for low-income housing that occurred in the 1980s. And then we also have testimony from the department in 2011 that states that the purpose is the development of housing affordable to households with incomes up to 80% of the area median income, the preservation of housing with federal rent subsidy contracts, and the preservation of manufactured dwelling parks. So that's kind of the purpose that we're looking at for this tax credit. An example here, this credit is unique in many ways. So this is a very simplified example where, say, under market conditions, loans for these projects to build these projects would carry with it a 5% interest rate. And if that loan were made over 10 years, this is what the payment stream would look like. The annual payments would be about $194,000. And within that, you have the principal, which increases over time, and the interest, which declines over time. And it's this stream of interest that's key for understanding the tax credit. So after the end of the 10 years, you see the $1.5 million loan is repaid. And in total, you have $1.9 million in payments made because there'll be $442,000 in interest payments. So because of the tax credit, the lender can make the loan at 1%. And so primarily, that affects all of the numbers, but the key thing is the interest payments right here. Over the life of the loan, the lender will only get about $84,000 in interest payments instead of $442,000 in interest payments. And that difference is the tax credit. And so that's what these numbers are right here. Every year, in the first year, they would be able to claim $60,000 in tax credits. So arguably, the lender is indifferent to this because they're making the same amount of money. And that's one of the advantages of the program. And it piggybacks on some federal policies to get these loans made. A graphical example. This is just a graphical version of the table information I just provided. The loan payments that the bank would receive over time are here in blue. And under a low interest loan, that's the green line. And the difference, the spread here, is equal to the tax credit. So every year, the bank would be able to claim the tax credit. In terms of the cost of the tax credit, this is information from tax returns and some estimates going back to 1990. So we have, for the most part, the credits claimed and used has increased over time. The program cap has increased over time, and I'll get to that. And in recent years, it's gone up to levels where we're seeing about $7 or $8 million a year. That's what it's costing the general fund in tax credits claimed. Here's some other information that I got from the housing department. The number of affordable housing units each year ranged from about 400 to 1,100. And these are the housing units that are supported by the program. And the housing units by income group, the labeling here is a little misleading, but if we start at the lowest income, about 10% of the housing goes to households with less than 30% of the area median income. About 11% goes to households between 30 and 40% of area median income. So most of the housing goes to household, most of the tax credit helps families between 40% and 80% of area median income. And this last graph on this one is the program cap and the outstanding tax credits. So one of the things that 2852 does is increase the cap. So since the beginning of the program, this blue line shows the cap for the outstanding tax credits. And it started off at about just $2 million and gradually increased throughout the 90s And then when we hit the odd years, we had a couple of big increases to try and meet demand. Because throughout the 80s, we were coming back every couple of years and increasing it. And so we had a couple of big steps to accommodate demand. Now, at the beginning of session, we thought we were pretty close to the cap. But when we analyzed the credit and got into the data and the details, we realized we have a little more room under the cap. I think you might hear from the agency on that. And so right now, we're somewhere around $12 million of the $17 million cap. And so the department will issue the tax credits up until this cap. And right now, I think you're going to hear a bunch of information about the demand far outweighing the supply. And so without a change in the cap, we're going to hit that cap, and then that will put kind of a brakes on the program and affect that. Now, one of the things you're also going to hear about is in 2852 is an auction. It's a new policy for the tax credit, and it's a way to leverage some of the tax credit. The way the program works is the housing department sends out a notice of availability for the loans, say $2 million. And then interested parties will come in and they'll apply to get one of the loans tied to the credits. And when that happens with the housing agency, these credits are put on reserve. So they're just earmarked for those lenders when those projects get built and the banks to eventually use the tax credits. Now that can be 1 to 2 years from the time that they get reserved. The loan gets shopped around before it actually hits the revenue stream. And so the department has to keep track of this because of the program cap. They can't have outstanding tax credits that exceed the $17 million. But during the time where credits are reserved, they're not hitting the revenue stream yet. They can't be claimed on tax returns. The department just has them earmarked as reserved. So one of the policies in 2852 is an auction of those tax credits that are on reserve, a one-year auction of those tax credits. So the housing department and the Department of Revenue would auction those tax credits for 1 year, and then taxpayers would purchase those and they would claim those that year, and then they would be redeemed, so they would still be under the program cap by the time the banks started claiming the tax credit on their returns. So there's been a lot of questions, and I've been talking to folks about the revenue impacts of this, and they kind of fall into three categories. We have the extension of the sunset, which will have little, if any, revenue impact in 17-19. Under current law, the credit sunsets on 1-1-20. And the reason for the early review is this advance notice for kind of the investment in this housing. So that's likely to have little or no impact. And then raising the cap is another policy. Bill 2852 increases that cap from $17 million to $25 million. So until that could also have, that could have a revenue impact, but because we have room under the current cap, we would have to hit the current cap before the amount above the $17 million would come into play and have a revenue impact. And so that's unlikely to have a revenue impact in 17-19. But the auction piece could have an immediate revenue impact. And right now in the bill, there aren't any limits. And so the committee, you have before you a variety of policy options for controlling that revenue impact in terms of the amount of tax credits that can be auctioned in any given year. So that's kind of a quick overview of this tax credit and some of the mechanics. I think you're going to hear more about the need for it and maybe from the department on how they administer the program. But those are the mechanics and the bills that are before you with respect to that tax credit. So I don't know if you want me to move on or if there are
quick questions. Questions on this topic then. Senator Riley.
Thank you. So the auction of those tax credits is in effect an extension from the 20 years to maybe 21 or 22 years for the tax credit, in effect.
Chair Barnhart, Senator Riley, I'm trying to see how it adds on. It doesn't add on to the length of the loan. So if the credit is issued for a 20-year loan, it's only going to be associated with the 20-year loan. But that if, say, I'm a lender, I come in and I get the tax credit right now in 2017, I go out and it'll be 2018 or 2019 before I actually start using the tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 20 years would be from 2019 on, and the auction would enable credits to be used in, say, tax years 2017 and 2018. I think that's how you're getting to that extension.
Exactly. So in your example, if I may.
Please.
In your example, we've added 2 years to the use of that tax credit.
Potentially. It would be 1 year at a time.
Right. But in your example, where it was sold for 2 years, that was, we added 2 years to the length of the tax credit.
Yes. Each year, the amount of tax credits that are on reserve or some other cap set by the assembly, housing and revenue would be able to auction off that amount, be it $1 million or $2 million. And the revenue raised from that auction would go to an account administered by the housing department for other housing programs. It's a way of leveraging the credit, if you will, for other housing programs. There are a lot of ways to describe it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Krista, I met with some folks the other day that put these affordable housing complexes together, and they had a list of how they stack these different programs. Is there any way, and I don't see anything here that addresses that, how this particular part fits, but it seemed to me in that conversation that every project was unique. I mean, there's so many variables, very, very difficult to figure out, at least in that conversation. I was assured at the end of the conversation that there was a need, but I'm not quite sure how to measure it.
And I forgot to mention, in OLIS is the tax credit report that was released in February. And in the chapter, if you will, on this, I go through an example there, and it shows some of those other sources. And the department will be able to describe in more detail, I think, how these packages fit together. And they are very unique. When you've seen one package, you've seen one package. But there is a federal credit. There are some potential issues with the federal credit right now, given the state of the federal budget and all of those issues. But the packages, to my understanding, can be complex. And it's tough to summarize those in one slide and say, this is what the typical program looks like. But the housing agency may be able to give a much better answer on some of the pieces. But you have the federal credit for one, you have this credit, and then other sources of funds that could affect the tax credits. One difference between the federal credit is that's kind of what we would call a production subsidy, where it's a direct credit to reduce the cost of capital to build more of these units, whereas this tax credit, the value of the tax credit has to be passed for most of the projects. There are some exceptions, but for most of the projects, the value of the tax credit has to be passed on to the low-income renters. So that's different from the federal credit. And from the lender's perspective, the credit is structured so that they're indifferent between taking the credit and not taking the credit. But there are some federal policies in place that encourage the lenders to make these kinds of loans.
Yeah, please.
Right. I think it's just, I think I will go ahead and talk to the folks that are in charge of these. Although I must say the conversation, you almost have to have an expert in these areas sitting beside you, because it's become a real complex matter to put these together. Mm-hmm. And so measuring the value of it here is very, very, very difficult.
I've had similar conversations in an attempt to boil it down to a paragraph or a chart, and I have yet to do that.
Right. Thank you.
I've been tangentially involved in several of these. And I think the discussion here is exactly right. My sense of it is that there might be a dozen different pieces to the financing, any one of which, the absence of any one of which, would torpedo the whole project. And so nobody should think that this program is likely to be the only thing. There are going to be a bunch of others. And maybe we'll hear some testimony about that later. Are we ready to go on to the next piece? Okay.
The next one that you have, the next credit policy you have before you today is the residential energy tax credit. Basically, individuals are allowed a tax credit that for qualifying devices, and there's a long list of devices, and the amounts vary per credit. But from a policy standpoint, for the most part, The value of the credit is the least of three things: the installed capacity or energy yield savings multiplied by a dollar value set in statute, 50% of the device, the cost of the device, or a dollar amount that is in statute, $1,500, $25, or $6,000. So it's the least of those three calculations is the value of the tax credit. The exception to that is home charging and alternative fuel stations, which is 50% up to the cost of the, for 50% of the cost of the device up to $750. No more than $1,500 can be claimed in any 1 year. Some of the tax credits can be as large as $6,000. So those are basically four-year tax credits, $1,500 every year. And the credit has a five-year carry forward. And some of these credits can be transferred. That we're on the order, last time I checked, of a few hundred of them get transferred in every year, 300, 400, 500 out of 15,000 tax credits or so. Mm. So again, touching back on the purpose statement, again, just to hammer home the point of the value of a purpose in evaluating the tax credits. This one, as is common, it's not in statute. The implementing legislation does refer to the cost of fossil fuels, the need to conserve energy, and then the economic feasibility of alternative forms of energy. So kind of the standard arguments that people are familiar with. And then Odo testified in 2015 before the Energy Committee and described the purpose as promoting energy savings or energy displacement and market transformation. So that's kind of the information we have on the policy purpose. And here's just a table with the different amounts. This was taken, these are the 2017 tax credits taken from Odo's website. So you can see how they vary. A lot of times, depending on the efficiency, they're just different dollar amounts or they are a function of the energy displaced. Oh, and this table, a few years ago, the legislature allowed the Department of Energy to modify the incentive value depending on market conditions. So this was an example of where the administration of the tax program resulted in a declining incentive value over time. Odo was able to evaluate the market and then determine that the incentive level for solar photovoltaic could be reduced from $2.10 per watt of installed capacity down to $1.30 as of this year. And that's in the context of these incentives, it's relatively new for the legislature to give the executive branch the ability to modify these incentives. But this is something that the committee has been trying in recent years. So the cost of the tax credit, as shown on the tax returns here, is about $12 to $15 million a year. We see the decline here going from, in 2012, a lot of changes were made to the tax credit. That was from the 2011 legislature. And the number of claimants went from about 57,000 down to about 14,000. And the big piece that was removed there were appliances. The legislature basically raised the bar on appliances that would qualify for the tax credit. So you see the revenue cost decline here, and the number really fall off. Since then, it has been climbing again, and we're about up to $14 million a year for RETC.
Representative Johnson,
Here.
Please.
So, Chris, I see you've got $14 million for 17-19, but on the slide you had at the beginning of the presentation, that goes to $43 million in 19-21 and $63 million in 21-23. What's responsible for that significant ramp-up?
Part of, Chair Barnhart, Rep. Johnson, part of that is a bit of an illusion because we're at about $20 million right now. So if it were allowed to sunset, some of these credits are four-year tax credits. So there's kind of a tail here. So that $14 million cost is an increase in the non-four-year tax credits. So the jump going from $14 million to about $20 million is really a full sunsetting of that tail. So under current law, it'll be a few years before the RETC goes away entirely. And then, but if it were reinstated or if the sunset were to continue, we basically stay at that $20 million. And it is growing slightly over time. Mm-hmm. And most of that, and the next chart here, it's been renewables and heat pumps that have been driving the use of the tax credit in recent years.
Yeah. Well, it's just important for us to keep in mind. Oh. I mean,
and thank you for the question. I had the same thought. Please go ahead.
So building on that, here is information from ODO on 2015 certifications. We have about 7 different types of devices, and you can see the number they get used most often are furnaces and boilers, heat pumps, and then the amounts also are the renewables at about $11 million and heat pumps at about $7 million. So whether you prefer tables or graphs, the information is conveyed here that in 2015, of the $21 million in tax credits that were certified that year, half of them were renewables, and then about a third of them were heat pumps. And then the next largest group are furnaces and boilers. So this is helpful to keep in mind as the committee considers, first of all, whether or not to extend the tax credit, and then if so, in which form. You have a couple of levers before you. You have the incentive value, the rate, if you will, but then you also have the eligible devices. Those are certainly policy choices that the committee can make in any form of a RETC that may continue. And information, we have some geographic information. This is kind of an odd chart. I didn't want to take the space to list all 36 counties. So for the most part, about 1% of tax filers claim a RETC. So, and that's pretty constant across the counties. Lane County has 1.4. I think that's the highest in terms of share. And then for the most part, the average is on the $800 to $900, except for Coos County. And that average of 5,000 is driven by a small number of claimants using the renewables. So it just drives up the average.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you tell us what percentage of taxpayers claim this. Do we know what income level these folks are who claim this?
And this chart, or sorry, Co-Chair Barnhart, Senator Riley, this chart shows the share of full year filers by income category. So we can see for filers down in $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 of income, it's a little bit less than 0.5% of filers claiming it. And then once we get into filers above 100,000, it's about 3% of filers claiming it.
Wood River.
It must be Hood River, right? Yes.
All right.
Representative Bantz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, could you go back to that geographic distribution? If this is an old question, and it's been asked many times back in the Energy and Environment Committee, but it's the overlap between the Energy Trust program on the one hand and this program on the other. And I note that a very, very large percentage, it would appear, of the 16,000 claimants come from areas that are within the ETO, reach of the ETO. And I believe their budget now is up pushing $200 million or $150 million. And grows every year. It would be interesting to me to see if we were to do away with this program entirely and simply point at the ETO, how many people we'd be leaving out. Is that possible to
I think so. I've started exploring that. In the tax credit report, I do list some of the ETO incentives. I believe ETO is here, and I don't know if they've signed but to testify, but I believe they're in the room. And that is kind of the next thing. We get the issue, as veteran members are well aware, it's kind of a stacking and how the incentives fit together, whether it's a straight-up stacking, if you will, of a tax credit like this and federal incentives and ETO and a state tax credit, or a bundling of a financing package like the housing tax credit. So I've only just begun to start to explore how much of what that overlap is and how it all fits together.
Follow-up.
Yes, please.
And of course, it takes us instantly to the value of the program, the return on investment, all those normal questions. Are you going to be providing us with more data on that, or do we need to go back into our files? Because we've had this conversation numerous times.
Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Bantz, this is one of, as I've testified to policy committees throughout the session, I've tried to drive home this point of the need for data. If the tax credits are going to continue, and the legislature wants this analysis, which all indications are we do with the tax credit report that we're required to produce, and the information, and very reasonable questions like the one you just posed, we need to get that information. And I don't have a lot of that readily available. I think parts of it may exist in different places, but I can't go back to my office right now and have that all in one spot. So I've been talking to members and policy committees about the need for somehow collecting that information and just acknowledging that and incorporating it into the process so that future committees do have that information and we have a clearer understanding of return on investment and those kinds of questions. The tax credit report goes through and tries to explore where possible some of those kinds of things or examples of kind of analysis that can be done if we have sufficient data. But we are still in a place where we need more data to get to provide you better analysis and answer to those questions.
Follow up.
Please.
And if you could return to that 2015 certifications slide. I recall that one of the rationales underlying this years ago when we first looked at it was that we would help nascent industries get going. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to guess that heat pumps, furnaces, and boilers are not nascent and probably don't have that argument available to them when it comes to outlining why we would keep investing in this particular space. But when you're asking for additional information that you would need in order to make a call on whether or not we should be doing this kind of thing, I guess that would be one of the things that would appear on it. What other things would you, when you say you need more data, what is it that you're thinking we would help our committee make a better decision? I'm going to take a guess and say we put together a list of tax credit things before. Is that what you're driving toward?
For the most part, some of the context in the past has always been the but-for question. You know, if this tax credit didn't exist, would anybody buy any of these things? And that question is the appropriate question.
Yeah.
It's just a very high bar. So I think if we approach it in a more incremental fashion about collecting whichever information we can get easily that isn't, say, cost prohibitive, then all of that is a step in the right direction toward providing those answers. That but-for question is extremely high, and the way I usually characterize that question is if I'm a disbeliever in a tax credit, if I don't believe that it does anything, that I believe it's 100% waste, if you will, what information is going to convince me that I'm wrong about that and it does have an impact? And that varies across, you know, person to person. So that's kind of the goal to get to, but there are a lot of steps in between there, just information. So the heat pumps, I think these are high-efficiency heat pumps. I'm not sure if Energy's in the room or if they could provide or if they're ready to talk in detail here. But that kind of information, they've collected some information on that. But it would be a matter, if we're certifying the tax credits, it's collecting a lot of detailed information. And some of that may get into demographics, and that may or may not be a place that they want to go. For example, somebody buys a heat pump, is it relevant to know what their income level is?
Right.
Okay. That may not be the case. But where we, and part of the reason that's not necessary at that point is it'll show up on a tax return and we'll be able to link it to income then. But some of these are policy decisions about being very clear about what you want to know. And there is that list, and I think we can move incrementally toward better information, and then that moves us in the right direction.
I would just point out, thank you, Mr. Chair, I would just point out for the committee that the A and Gross version of 2681, I think, is attempting to get at some of the things that Representative Benz is sort of talking about and our analyst is mentioning, like the report would require, you know, the amount of credits issued, demographic breakdown, residents of taxpayers. There's like a lot of things that have been put in this credit that I don't recall seeing in other discussions about tax credits that I think help us. You know, like, frankly, I'm going to copy this amendment for some other tax credits that we're looking at to see if we can do that so we can have a better analysis if these things are working or not.
Thank you.
I didn't come up with it, but I think it's a great amendment. I just pointed out.
Right. Thank you. Other comments? And then I think you had one last slide that we hadn't really talked about. I think you raised it in answer to Senator Riley or somebody's question, or Representative Johnson, perhaps.
Yes, this was from the poorly labeled graph. I think tax year 2014. So we have income here, and the share of the full year filers, so everybody who's required to file a tax return, and the share of those filers that claim the residential energy tax credit. And it does, as I think people expected, it corresponds with income. So if your income is between 10 and 20,000, about 0.3% of those filers claimed some kind of RETC. And once you get up to about $300,000 of income, it kind of levels off at about 3.2-3.3% of filers. And that can be driven by a few things. Obviously, higher income, more disposable income, they're probably more likely to invest in some of these technologies. You also have the fact that the credit is non-refundable. And so because it's non-refundable, it really mutes the ability for lower income folks to take advantage of that tax credit. They basically don't have the tax liability to use the credit. And that's a general situation for, it's the challenge that you face when trying to implement certain other policies through the tax code. Once you have non-refundable tax credits, and there are arguments for refundability either way, but one of the things it does do, if tax credits are non-refundable, it mutes the ability for lower income folks to use it. There are other, it's not nearly as simple as I'm stating right here, just acknowledging a couple reasons why this is associated with income.
Thank you. Anything else for Chris, or can we go on to the bills? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Colleagues, we have a small number of witnesses on the bills having to do with the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit, so we're going to open that first, but I will note that we have about an hour, and we want to get a whole bunch of people in, so I'll ask everybody to be extremely brief. With that, we'll open the public hearings on House Bill 2852 and Senate Bill 166. Chris, you're going to give us actually, you've already given us most of it. Is there anything in addition to your presentation that you wanted to talk about now?
I think I touched on all the main pieces. The extension, the increase, you have the extension of the credit, an increase in the cap, and then this auction piece to leverage the tax credits that have been reserved but aren't being utilized at that time.
Right. Thank you. Representative Helm, I assume you're here on the other one. Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Hi, thank you. I know you're really busy today, so I'm just going to say a few words. State Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm the chair of the Human Services and Housing Committee, and I'm aware that none of the other sponsors on this bill, particularly the chief sponsor, are able to be here today, so I just wanted to say something on behalf of the committee. First of all, it was every tax credit that comes to our committee we thoroughly review, as you may remember from the child care tax credits that we did 2 years ago. In this case, I assigned Representative Mark Meek and Ron Noble to really dig into this. And they met 5 different times starting in March with the advocates to really look at how we can make this tax credit the most flexible it could be, which is why they looked at the idea of the auction in addition to just the regular way that we extend the tax credit. And also because we were starting to get close to that 17 million cap, they wanted to expand it to the 25 million. They thought actually that wouldn't entirely meet the need, and particularly if we do things in another bill that would speed up permitting, we hope that there's a lot more construction that will be happening for affordable housing. But if we meet that cap as well, that we can look at that in the future, expanding it. So we had a lot of testimony from not-for-profit and for-profit affordable housing developers. They're very dependent on this. Whenever they try to put an affordable housing project together, they try to take from the federal tax credit, which, as Chris said, is a little bit unpredictable right now. They compete for this 4% tax credit at the state level. They use whatever they can from the document recording fee and whatever other pieces they can piece together. I did just post on OLIS the housing report that the Housing Community Services presented to us back on February 7th, I believe it was. There's a few different pages that are particularly interesting, I think, for this. One is the number of units that we need. I believe that's on page 22. If you can flip to 22 really quickly. So we are just way behind in the housing permits that we need to meet our need. I'm not sure exactly what page, but I think it's on page 28, but it's not labeled 28, so just go 6 pages forward. No, but the other way. 6 pages. Go from 22 to 28. So go That one. So you can also see that we have a gap of about 100,000. If you look at the red and the blue, the extremely low income and then the low income, how many units we have available versus how many households we have, it looks like we're about 100,000 units too few for in affordable housing. So this is really a huge, huge crisis, as you know. I probably don't need to go into great detail about the need for this, but I just want to say the only money that we really have on the table to help with both preserving and constructing new affordable housing is this particular house credit at the state level, as well as the document recording fee, which brings in about, I think it's about $13 million a year, and it gets divided between the emergency housing assistance rental program and home ownership, and then 76% of that particular recording fee, which is, I believe, also in front of your committee, or it's in front of the revenue committee, goes to preservation and construction. So these are two very important tools and the only ones that we really have to assist at the state level with affordable housing. So I just wanted to say that, and I do want to just say that it's very extremely efficient. It provides a huge benefit in terms of the technicality of the auction. I'm going to leave that to Bill Van Vliet, who's here, that from NOAA, who really then affordable housing group that worked on that and knows the technicalities better. But I just can't say enough on behalf of my entire committee, all nine of whom voted for this, how important this tool is.
Thank you.
Okay.
Questions for Representative Kenny Geyer? Thank you so much.
Thank
you. We very much appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Today. Allison McIntosh, Bill Van Vliet, Marcia Kelly, please. No, this is who I have signed up for this segment. Please go ahead.
Okay. Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance. Thank you for your time today. As you know, the Oregon Housing Alliance is a coalition of more than 80 organizations from all parts of the state, and our members have come together with the knowledge that housing opportunity is the foundation on which all of our success is built. We represent a diverse set of voices, including residents, local jurisdictions, nonprofit housing developers, and organizations working to meet basic needs in every corner of our state. We believe that all Oregonians need a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. And as you all well know, today we simply don't have enough affordable homes for people who need them. One in four renters today pays more than 50% of their income towards rent, leaving too little money left over for basics like food, medicine, and transportation. We can do more as a state to provide this opportunity for all Oregonians. We have a strong network of affordable housing developers all across the state, and with more resources, we could build more affordable homes for the Oregonians that need them. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, or OAHTC, is a proven and effective tool, and since 1989, the credit has provided thousands of Oregonians with safe and affordable housing by directly lowering the rents. So I know Chris gave a great overview of how this worked, but we'll just go back over it very quickly. The credit is awarded to an affordable housing developer by Oregon Housing and Community Services, our state's housing finance agency, as part of a package of resources that would help put together a new project or a project that to preserve an existing affordable housing project. At that point, the credit is considered to be reserved. The developer then takes that award to a financial institution who is willing to issue a mortgage loan for the property. The bank lowers the interest rate on the loan by up to 4%, and the credit that the bank claims is equal to the amount of interest rate reduction they give the affordable housing project. The developer then passes the benefit through to the residents of the project in the form of lowered rents. And once the mortgage loan is closed, OHCS certifies the credit and the bank begins to claim the credit against their state tax liability. The credit provides a long-term benefit and keeps rents lowered for tenants for 20 years. The credit lowers rents as soon as the project is completed, meaning tenants benefit as soon as they move in. The credit also helps to preserve and facilitate the development of additional affordable homes for Oregonians. Since 1989, the credit has helped build over 17,000 units, and 41% of those projects were built in rural communities, for the purpose of which we defined that as a community with a population of less than 50,000 people. As with all state tax credits, the credit is scheduled to sunset every 6 years so that it can be reviewed by you to ensure it continues to be an effective tool and an effective use of state resources. House Bill 2852, in addition to extending the sunset on this credit for an additional 6 years, also increases the cap, as Chris said, to $25 million. As Chair Kenny Geyer noted, Representative Meek and Noble participated in a work group with Bill and I, along with Housing and Community Services and Chris, to discuss the credit and ways it could be made more effective. I sent in a summary of that process for OLIS. We discussed both the sunset extension, increasing the cap, and ways to make the credit more effective. Initially, House Bill 2852 actually proposed increasing the cap from the current $17 million to $34 million a year, and after discussion, the two representatives recommended a smaller increase to $25 million per year. Bill is going to discuss the other part of that amendment that was adopted by the committee to increase resources available for affordable housing, specifically to target manufactured home park preservation and replacement. As Representative Kenny Geyer noted, the committee unanimously approved House Bill 2852. So increasing the cap on this credit will give Housing and Community Services really critical resources to build an additional affordable housing across Oregon. The credit is a very effective tool also to help preserve existing affordable housing, as well as to purchase manufactured home parks in order to ensure they continue to be affordable. We know we absolutely need to increase the supply of affordable housing in our state, and this is a really critical tool to help us do that. It's one of our priorities as the Housing Alliance to extend the sunset and on this credit, as well as to increase the cap. Before I close and turn it over to Bill, I would just note we've submitted a number of materials to OLIS, including some background information on the credits posed by you as the Joint Tax Credit Committee. We also have a super fancy map. It's a little bit of sarcasm. It's not super fancy, but it does show the distribution of projects across the state. We also submitted a list of all of the projects that have been built with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit by county since the inception of the credit in 1989. So thank you so much for your time today and for your service.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vliet, and I'm the executive director with NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. NOAA is a statewide nonprofit lender that provides a variety of financing programs for affordable housing projects. To date, we have financed over 9,500 of those 17,000 units that have been produced, and 86% of those loans have used this tax credit program to offer lower rents to their residents. So it's been a big part of our program over a long period of time. A lot has been already discussed about how the credit works, and I will try and truncate my comments in that and this for the sake of time. Excuse me. But this is, I just want to remind everybody, this credit is a little different than most tax credits because it's not purchased and sold. It attaches to a loan and is delivered over a 20-year period of time. And since it's claimed annually, it is not it's not discounted and sold. 100% of the credit goes to the policy impact, which I think is very impressive in the world of a lot of tax credit programs. There is a handout that I have shared. Actually, I think most of you have probably seen it previously. It should be an OLIS for you. And in the back of that, there are some examples here that do the math, walk you through how the rent reductions are calculated. The other thing that's important on this handout on the back is there's another example. There it is. Thank you. Down just below this one, so you can see the rent reduction there. And this would be the same project serving the same population and the same income levels. If we didn't have this credit, it would take $660,000 of capital, cash investment from the state to reach the same population. So you can see the leveraging ability that we get out of this program. So take a look at that if you wish. So we have the bill does three things. It extends the sunset, which we've talked about. These projects take a long time to get developed. Developers need to know well in advance that this resource will be available when they're designing their financing packages. The other thing is increasing the cap, and that the need is overwhelming, and we know from the department's projections that they will be hitting this cap very rapidly, and so our ability to continue to serve low-income populations will be dependent on increasing the cap for years to come. In the past, they've been rationing this credit because we've known they've been approaching this cap, and so some projects have not been awarded credits who would be eligible, and others have received partial allocations. We can have far more impact and reach far more low-income households if we can actually apply this to every loan that comes through that qualifies. And then the third component is the new piece, and it would allow Oregon Housing to use the Department of Revenue's auction process for credits that are reserved but not yet claimed. And really that gets to this long timeline where we can have, and I think Senator Riley pointed out, we can have up to 2 years where credit has been allocated and essentially taken out of the system, but it's not been put to use. And so what this auction process would allow is for those reserved credits to be put to use during that construction period for the other project. And this is really a kind of a separate process that would develop a resource that would go to finance other pressing housing needs. And Allison mentioned the bill recommends manufactured home park preservation and the replacement of dilapidated manufactured homes, which are a big health and environmental and energy problem. The bill limits the auction to the amount that is reserved and not all the way to the cap necessarily. The legislature could certainly choose to place a monetary cap on that to give yourself some budget assurity as to what the impact might be in any given year. So I just will close with that quick overview. I know we've been a lot of folks have given you good information today, but thank you for your attention to this matter.
Thank you very much. Marcia.
Chair Barnhart and Chair Hassan, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, but today I'm here as the co-chair of the HISCO Tax and Revenue Committee. HISCO has a longstanding position of supporting tax credits that are worthy and serve the populations that most of our members clients and serving those needs. And this affordable housing tax credit has been around, has proven its worth, and is worthy of HISCO's support. We believe that targeted tax credits can be very, very helpful in making Oregonians secure in their homes, and this is the type of targeted tax credit that we think serves the population most needful in our state.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Riley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's no surprise, and everybody knows I'm not a real fan of tax credits, but this tax credit is an exception. Because of the leveraging of this money, we get, I think, more out of it than we put into it. And so I'm really supportive of this. I wanted to point out, I think, in a conversation I had, that when the auction piece that we're talking about, there is a percentage requirement of 95%. To sell those, so I think that's a good point as well.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Thank you so much. Very much appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2852 and Senate Bill 166, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2681 and Senate Bill 177. Chris, you're on that one too, aren't you? Yes, of course. You're on all of these for this committee.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these two bills are the residential energy tax credit. The Senate bill is just the six-year extension, and the House bill is the six-year extension, but with some data requirements and reporting requirements that I think you're about to hear.
Added on. All right. Gentlemen, thank you. And thank you, Representative Helm, for sticking around.
It's fun here on Fridays, isn't it?
I can't say I've missed it.
Co-chairs Hass and Barnhart and committee members, for the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is inner southeast Portland and a little sliver of northeast Portland. I think a lot of you know I was a big supporter of Measure 97 and just like Senator Riley, I'm kind of skeptical about tax credits as well. And while our budget and healthcare situation certainly feel like the most pressing issues that we have here in Salem for the moment, I think most of us would hopefully agree that a real pressing issue for our time is trying to figure out how we're going to deal with climate change. We know that weather is changing because of all the carbon we're putting in the air, and we have to make progress on reducing our carbon emissions and reliance on fossil fuels and still have electricity to power and run our economy at the same time. And I think having a financial incentive to promote solar energy and energy efficiency helps with that. And one way we do that is to offer this tax credit to people to make the switch to these kinds of technologies. More Oregonians are wanting the energy independence and reliability that these products provide. They want to save money on their utility bills, and they view solar and energy efficiency as an investment that they can make in the value of their homes. And I think many also want to do their part to help solve global warming and cut health-harming pollution. This bill is also, in my opinion, good for our state's economy. When Oregonians by the thousands are installing these products, it's good for our state. The solar and energy efficiency industries provide exactly the kind of high-paying jobs we want to bring to our state. You know, it wasn't too long ago that when a homeowner looked to install solar, they would have had a hard time finding a company to do it. The RETC helps drive homeowner demand for solar energy, which gives rise to solar companies. And then as those companies grow, so did the economies of scale, which help bring the price of these kinds of things down. Eventually, this industry is going to be able to stand on its own in the near future. As a result, we won't need this incentive. It won't be necessary. But I don't think that that day is here before us just yet. And you know, to my slightly disparaging remarks earlier about tax credits and my skepticism for them, I have learned a little bit being in the Revenue Committee about how they work, and they're not all necessarily bad. Giving business, or in this case persons, a tax break to incentive behavior is like the state giving a loan or a grant. In the private market, when it's too hard for them to do it, then government coming in giving the free market a boost is probably a good idea. Additionally, the bill before you, and I kind of touched on this a little bit when Representative Bentz was discussing how we track this, the A and Gross version does something that I think is really significant that I've not seen in my time here so far discussing tax credits in my first or second term, and that it requires the department to report to the legislature every long session about the progress this credit is making. So the department would have to make a report about the number of credits that were given, the amount of the credit, the demographics of who's getting the credit, including income and zip codes, energy efficiency achieved, as well as the greenhouse gas reduction and jobs that were created. So kind of like what we do in the Ways and Means process, or I assume that what we do, since I'm not on any of those committees, where we analyze, is the program good? Is it achieving the outcome that we're hoping it will do? We'd be able to do the same thing for this tax credit. And for all of those reasons, I hope the committee will support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Bell.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, Ken Helm, State Representative for House District 34. I don't have to repeat a lot of the details about the program because I see that five of our nine members of the House Energy and Environment Committee are here, and for that I'm thankful. My reason in being here today is to urge that you work with this proposal and formulate a way for the RETC to go forward toward the end of its life in a reasonable and predictable way. I agree with my colleague, Representative Nose, that we are fast approaching the time where this assistance won't be needed. But my great fear is that we'll turn off the tap for this assistance abruptly and prematurely, and it will it'll be the death knell for our rooftop solar businesses in this state. District 34 is right next to District 30, which is where the Solar World plant is, and regardless of whether that plant stays or goes, we have a robust rooftop solar industry in Oregon. It will go away nearly overnight if we turn off the tap for these types of tax credits. I have been in meetings now three or four times with representatives of the solar rooftop industry in Oregon and representatives from business in Washington. The story in Washington is the tax credits ran out one day, and virtually the next day, the industry was gone. They had to move on. It simply wasn't penciling out for them, and they needed to look for places in adjacent states where they could do, where they could sustain the businesses and the employees that were relying on them. That same story played itself out in Ohio a number of years ago, and I know that several members of the committee have been to the, both the National Environmental Caucus meeting. And also attended the Lehigh Legislative Energy Horizons Institute educational process, where we learned a little bit about the rooftop industry. What happened in Ohio is they didn't necessarily end the program, but the legislature and the governor said, oh, well, we'll just push pause for a year. It doesn't work that way. They pushed pause for a year, and the industry went away. So we can't think that we are going to maybe suspend the RETC program for a couple years, and then if we see that the industry is struggling, we'll restart it again. I don't think that that is a reasonable conclusion to make. What I would recommend that the committee think about is a number of ways to start refining the system down toward its end of life. That may include a means test for income, so that we get this capability to more folks that could utilize it, and it would mitigate their monthly budget by reduced energy prices. You may want to cap the program. You may want to reduce the types of devices that it applies to. You may want to think about whether you reduce the end of life of the program from 6 years to 4 years or something like that. I would much prefer that the committee think about those types of refinements and scaling down leading to a smaller, more nimble program that's a little bit more focused on certain industries as we approach the end. Businesses will tell you over and over, and you've heard it here before, that they accept regulation, but they need to understand a plan for the future. They need to know where they're heading. If we can help them see what is at the end of 4 years or so from now and help them plan for a day when they don't have the tax credit, I think we'll do ourselves as a state a great service and these businesses that rely on the tax credit now.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Riley, please.
Thank you very much. So you mentioned Solar World, and they are in my district. And their problem, of course, is the Chinese. It's not the RETC or whether it's going to stay or go. It's the pricing that the Chinese are able to do because of their currency policies. And so, I think one of the things we need to do is find a way for our manufacturers in this country to be able to supply these without depending on imports from China. That would be very helpful.
I didn't detect a question there. Representative Johnson.
I had no question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it, both of you, for being here. Each of you, I think, in your testimony mentioned that this tax credit, if it's extended, will not need to go on in perpetuity. It'll be an end at some point. But I'm just curious what you're thinking about. How will we know
when
it's not needed? Is there a industry-recognized benchmark or something out there, i.e. in the price per watt or whatever, or vigor of the industry or consumer demand? I don't know what the criteria might be.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Johnson, I wouldn't be able to venture a guess for you on that. That's not my line of field or expertise, but there may be people that are lined up to testify after us that might have an opinion about that. And, you know, in a way, the regular look back that we are supposed to give these credits, as opposed to just letting them go on in perpetuity like we were doing, you know, several years before, gives us that opportunity to see. Like, maybe we don't know where that is, but we'll have an opportunity to analyze that 6 years from now, or if we take Representative Helm's suggestion, maybe 4 years from now.
Thank you.
Well,
yes, please.
Thank you.
And I will note that people in the back who are going to testify are busy scribbling additional notes so they can answer that question later.
Related to the draft, I guess this is the A and the 2681A, the report in here that I guess it's the department, is this ODO, that's going to compile this? Is there a direct outcome that is expected to come from this? Is this purely informational?
I think it's purely informational. Unless you got, what do you,
well, just wondering if it shows X, would Y be the result? You know,
well,
we haven't looked at it that way. I'm just throwing it out there.
Co-chairs and Representative Johnson, it may be that once we see what's collected, then we can task somebody to go away and sort of analyze that, or maybe what's collected will be obvious to us, right? And then we'll be able to say, okay, this has lived its life, or this is not doing what we want it to do, or it is. I just think that I'm just impressed by the fact that we would build, because I have heard criticism of tax credits quite a bit, and part of it is we don't know if it really does the thing that we're trying to incentivize to do. And I think the way that the A and gross is worded in Section 3 and Section 4, we have a better chance of finding out if the credit's really working.
One final follow-up.
Please.
Then. Representative Helm, you were mentioning some states that have modified their policies at various times, but do you know whether any of these other states, and I don't know the answer to that, have a public purpose charge like we have here in Oregon that also provides incentives or credits to qualifying, whether it be conservation and or renewable energy?
Co-chairs and Representative Johnson, I don't know the answer to the question.
You know, just getting back to Representative Bence's, I think, line of questioning earlier about, you know, there's about $190 million, I think, a year that comes in via the Energy Purpose Charge. And
so
what if that might be redirected to provide, if the state scaled back, could ETO scale up? I guess that would be the
line. We will be hearing from the Energy Trust
later,
and that may be useful.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
and Representative Johnson, too, I'll just, for the benefit of the rest of the committee, I know you've heard this before, just remind folks that, you know, the rest of the state served by various municipal utility districts, PUDs, and co-ops, and this credit's available to them, of course.
Sure.
And so we want to keep track of that. If there's some extra reliance on ETO funds to get this work done, we need to make sure that they're kept whole.
And, of course, part of that question is going to be, do they need the layering of both issues in order to get it done, or does it tend to happen across the state, even in places where there's only this credit and not the ETO dollars? Who knows? I will note that that the House Bill 2681 has several references to the Department of Energy. I'm also aware that there's some controversy about whether the administration of this tax credit should be moved to a different department. The comments you've made would be equally valid regardless of which department manages this program, wouldn't they?
I think so.
Co-chairs and Representative Barnhart, I think the analysis could be done by any number of agencies.
Right.
Of course, the value of the program is not dependent on the agency that oversees it. And to me, to be quite honest, the effort to move the RETC program out of the Department of Energy has less to do with the program and the needs of the program vis-a-vis that agency than the ongoing work to help the agency gain a better footing and realize its mission more specifically.
Thank you. Specifically, one of the potential amendments to the bill that would do that would allow the receiving department to consult with the Department of Energy on the areas that it has particular expertise on. And that might deal with, at least in part, with the issue that you were just referring to. Thank you. Anything else for these two? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will note that we have about half an hour that we're officially set up for. I'm going to follow Chair Helm's suggestion and say that I'm willing to stay and listen to everybody. But the extent to which people can abbreviate their presentation without doing violence to it, I'd appreciate that. Let's start with Jeff Bissonnette and Sean Franks, please. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. We are the solar trade group for the state. And I will keep my comments focused on a couple of the key discussion items that have come up. And then we have members of our association here that do the work, you know, boots on the roof, as we say, that can talk about the impact of the tax credit in their areas and on their business and their customers. I will say the RETC is very important to the solar industry. Costs are coming down. And while I can't either, like Representative Helm, give you a specific date on when we don't need the incentives, that is a discussion that is being driven in the industry. I will say that a lot of the ideas that Representative Helm had that this committee should take up in terms of either focusing the tax credit or containing the costs are good ones and ones that we hope that the committee is interested enough you know, in continuing this tax credit to be able to have the discussion around some of those issues. And there is some flexibility that the industry sees. One thing I'd like to add to that list is, you know, while I'm not willing to put a date on when the incentives won't be needed, I can say that we would be more than happy to, you know, report on an ongoing basis, you know, how we're doing and as the date becomes clear to be able to, you know, not just have a discussion now and wait for 4 years or 6 years or whatever, but to make sure the legislature is kept up to speed with where the industry thinks it's going. I will also say that some of the amendments that Representative Nose noted in terms of putting a purpose actually in statute and putting some metrics in there were from discussions that we've been having about the tax credit, and a lot of people thinking that, you know, we should have a better way to measure the effectiveness of the tax credits. And so those are where those amendments came from. And again, those were in discussion with the policy committee. If there are more that the members of this committee who are not involved in that discussion wanted to add, there's certainly an openness to that as well. And lastly, I'll just say something about the administration of the program. We have stated pretty consistently that we are agnostic as to where the program lives. I think it's been administered fine at ODO. If for you know, if ODO needs to focus as it rebuilds and this needs to live somewhere else, that's fine. All we want is a well-run program as it has been up till now. And if you know, the governor and or the legislature wants to identify an agency, we'll be more than happy to help manage that transition and be a part of that discussion. And so that is, you know, not an important piece to us. With that, I'll stop and happy to answer questions now or any other time if it's appropriate. Thanks.
Don't be surprised if there are some over the next couple of weeks as well. Thank you, Mr. Franks.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Haas, Barnhart, members of the committee, grateful for the chance to testify before you today. My name is Sean Franks, and I live at 321 Engel Street in Ashland, Oregon, with my gracious wife and two wonderful sons, Carter and Micah, who allowed me to be here today on such short notice. I'm testifying on behalf of my family at True South Solar in support of extending the RETC. Inspired by the urgencies of energy independence, Eric Hansen and Sean Schreiner founded True South Solar in 2010. Like the pioneers before them, they set out to provide high-quality solar to Southern Oregon businesses and homeowners. 7 years later, our team has grown to 19 employees, and we had over $4 million in revenue last year.
From Mount Ashland Ski Area to the Ashland Emergency Food Bank, our solar installations can be found on rooftops of businesses and homes throughout the Rogue Valley. We serve the many communities of Jackson and Josephine County, including Ashland, Talent, Phoenix, Medford, Jacksonville, Gold Hill, Shady Cove, Central Point, White City, Eagle Point, Grants Pass, as well as the greater Applegate and Rogue Valleys. We have installed over 3 megawatts of solar in our communities. The Red Sea is a tremendous driver for green job creation in Oregon. Our team at True South Solar will be among those solar installers, developers, and manufacturers throughout Oregon working on the front lines of our transition to a clean energy economy. The Red Sea will continue to provide new opportunities, not just for local installers, but throughout the supply chain. We understand that while it may not be easy, your leadership here today is essential to provide the certainty our industry thrives upon and to create even more green jobs. The mission of True South Solar is simple: solar on every rooftop and best jobs ever. The Red Sea is essential to that mission. I like to think of the solar industry as a sort of alchemy where we transmute sunlight using metals and simple things like sand into gold into our communities. These policies bring real monetary value, creates clean energy jobs, saves homeowners money, attracts additional resources through federal and utility incentives, and this policy is vital to our customers in obtaining solar on their homes. I fear if the Red Sea is allowed to sunset, the payback would extend beyond 10 years, and for us this would mean reduced installations, resulting in the loss of jobs. It would devastate the residential solar industry of Oregon. So I'm here to ask you, do not miss the opportunity to make Oregon a leader in renewable energy and energy efficiency. Imagine the enormous potential to create a highly skilled green energy workforce. The time to act is now. Be not afraid of greatness. Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Please extend the residential energy tax credit. And I want to thank the committee for the greatness inherent in the work you're doing, and as well as the opportunity to express my views. And on behalf of my family at True South Solar, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Franks. Questions for this panel? Senator O'Reilly, please. I'm going to do it all day.
I know, it's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you mentioned the revenue that the company made. Do you happen to know the profit margin for the company?
I don't. I apologize.
Could you find that for me, please?
Yes, I could.
That would be useful. Other questions? You're down in the lower southern but southwestern part of the state, which I'm less familiar with. Representative Marsh, of course, is very familiar with it. Perhaps you can tell us if any of those areas that where you work are within the energy trust areas, meaning they work with the investor-owned utilities, and which of the areas are in municipals or co-ops or other areas. Do you know about that?
Yes, Ashland is the only one that excludes Energy Trust of Oregon, and Ashland, the city of Ashland, has an incentive that has stayed pretty consistent, whereas the Energy Trust of Oregon incentives are dropping pretty rapidly because of the amount of solar adoption going on in the state. So it's a big success, but also that means that less resources are going to homeowners through the Energy Trust of Oregon, and that difference was about $6,500 last year, I think, was the max incentive, to now it's about to drop very shortly to about $1,800. So the incentives are taking a big dip. So as far as if a homeowner got an evaluation last year, that incentive from the Energy Trust would have went down significantly. And so we're doing all we can to push our costs down just because of the volume of our work. We're able to, you know, support Mount Ashland, Ashland Emergency Food Bank, because of those additional installations. And we pass that on to our community as well as our workforce.
Thank you. I think what you just said was that Ashland gives an equivalent or better support than the Energy Trust. In the area where the Ashland Power Company is.
Yes, so they've stayed at $7,500. I think it's about 50 cents a watt, whereas the Energy Trust is just rapidly declining.
Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Mr. Bissonnette?
Yeah, Co-Chair Barnhart, something that Sean said made me realize I'd forgotten to respond to something that Representative Johnson had brought up in terms of how do we know? And there's a bunch of different ways that you can measure that, but one of the key things that a lot of companies use and that we talk about in our Oregon solar plan that we released earlier this session is keeping that payback under 10 years. And that seems to be for homeowners in particular, you know, it's better if it's a shorter payback for businesses. But it's that payback that we really try and look at and keep it, particularly for residential customers, under that 10-year mark.
But this particular bill we're talking about only has to do with residential customers.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anything else with this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate it. And I appreciate the long drive, Mr. Frank. Wendy Gerlitz, Tim Miller, Mark Farrell, please.
Good afternoon.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Co-chairs Haas and Barnhart and committee members, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Wendy Gerlitz. I'm the policy director for the Northwest Energy Coalition. We're a nonprofit organization that works to promote clean energy across the Pacific Northwest. I submitted written testimony, so I don't want to read that, but I just want to cover
you.
A couple. Yeah. I'm a fast reader, too, so you probably wouldn't even be able to follow it. But I just want to cover a couple of highlights and a couple of the reasons that we are here today to promote the residential energy tax credits. We believe that this tax credit program is unique in Oregon because it really does promote a tremendous amount of economic benefit back to a broad cross-section of Oregonians, and it does that in a couple of different ways. One is actually through direct savings in the utility system, saving utility customers money. Both participants and non-participants benefit, especially from the energy efficiency programs, but also from the solar programs in that regard. And then, secondly, you've heard a lot about the energy businesses that rely on work throughout the state. And just for example, you've heard a little bit more about solar than energy efficiency, so I'm going to talk some numbers about energy efficiency businesses across the state. The U.S. Department of Energy estimates that there are over 40,000 jobs in the state that are devoted to the energy efficiency industry. 70% of those businesses are small businesses. And so this is a large industry that is really, you know, working in this area to promote energy efficiency. And I'll just say, you know, think about your own home. I don't know whether you've done any energy efficiency or not, but you know, it's difficult to take those steps, right? You have to invite in a contractor, you have to get bids, you have to, I mean, you know how, and so having the state sort of seal of approval through a program like this is a really important motivator, I think, to the residents of the state. And I think this plays an important role in giving sort of a state seal of approval. Yes, energy efficiency and solar is a really good thing to do. It helps us with our economy, it helps us reduce carbon emissions, it helps us with all of the goals that we as Oregonians have, you know, have said that we want to pursue. And so for that reason, I feel like this program is very important. There's more sort of economic benefit activity in my written testimony, but I wanted to provide one anecdotal example to address Representative Johnson's question of, you know, are these really programs really essential to this work? My sister, my family really likes clean energy. My sister owns a small business in Portland called Balanced Energy Solutions, running residential energy efficiency programs. When they started out several years ago, they had 13 employees. They have since then reduced their work to 4 staff people that they've had pretty consistently until this last year, and now they have 2. I had drinks with her last night, one of the benefits of, you know, working in the same area. And I asked her a few questions, and I said, how many of your customers get the benefit of tax credits? And she said 100% of the customers that do an eligible appliance or service in energy efficiency actually get the tax credits. And she said, and her feeling was that this tax credit program was very important to those customers. In fact, she told me that the person who processes those things sometimes gets a little behind. And she said, and when we get behind, we hear from those customers. They pick up the phone and they call us and they say, where is our paperwork? This tax credit is really important to me. And so her view was this really is motivating. And she was actually very concerned what would happen if the tax credit program goes away. And her feeling was that the demand for the energy efficiency services that they provide will go down. And she doesn't want to lay off any more of her workers. You know, these are moderate to lower income folks that are coming in to this workforce from construction jobs or other things. You know, sometimes they've gone through training. Sometimes she helps train them. So it's you know, it's helping. You saw the tax credits. Some of them are provided to moderate income, but the workforce is largely moderate income that we're serving here in this workforce here, and they're oftentimes getting a better paying job coming into this workforce. So I just wanted to provide you know, an anecdote from someone who runs a business that thinks this program is essential to her business.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Co-chairs Haas and co-chair Barnhart and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Tim Miller. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm the CEO of Enhabit, and I really appreciate the chance to provide our unique information. It echoes some of what Wendy just mentioned, but our unique information regarding the residential energy tax credit. Enhabit, as some of you know, is an Oregon nonprofit. Our mission is to create stronger communities through better living spaces, and that's particularly around single-family homes. And we work with local contractors throughout much of the state, and we've done helped over 5,000 Oregon families improve their homes. The firm that Wendy just mentioned is one of our partners doing this work. These homeowners that we work with improve their homes for energy efficiency. They put solar energy systems on their roofs. They're improving the affordability of their homes. They're making seismic strengthening investments and health-related improvements. But I'm really talking today about the energy efficiency primarily. So we know from our work with these thousands of customers that these incentives are a really important and crucial signal to them making these long-term investments in their homes. The deep energy improvements that we, our contractors, typically make are $12,000 to $15,000 improvements in these homes. And the about 40% of our customers take advantage of and leverage the energy tax credits. And they amount to $400 to $1,200 per house. So you can see that that's a pretty significant chunk of that investment that the tax credit is providing, an important motivator for them to do this work. And that motivator and them taking that action is what creates the jobs that we talk about in this community. The contractors take the energy tax credit and put it directly on their proposal. So the homeowner sees that tax credit. It's a critical part of selling these projects. Now, Enhabit has tracked and demonstrated the correlation between these incentives and the levels of customers taking action, and there's a clear correlation. It's critical to the development of these good family wage jobs with benefits, and these incentives are all the more important to encouraging homeowners to do this work because utility sector incentives are declining. Energy costs are low, utility sector incentives are low or going down, and so these incentives are really, really important. And in fact, due to utility cost effectiveness calculations, if these tax credits go away, some of the utility sector incentives will go away as well. So there's a compounding loss or impact on the sector if some of these credits go away. You can ask me about that in a minute if you'd like. I see the frown. Finally, there are other co-benefits that go along with these incentives. It's sort of a multiplying impact, unlocking these homeowner investments. Not only do these investments create local jobs, but homeowners are investing in the health and the long-term value of their homes and the housing stock in Oregon, and they ultimately help build more resilient communities. Homeowners are reducing their energy bills, and their home is getting more, their indoor air quality is improving, so they're saving on health costs. So there's an array of cascading benefits and multiplied benefits that come as a result of these tax credits. So they're also improving the affordability of their home and able to stay in their home in some cases due to these tax credits. So Enhabit has a unique experience on this, and we see folks starting off with an energy efficiency investment and then leading them into doing other things like seismic improvements and solar and other things. Now, in rural parts of the state, as we've heard a little bit about, these tax credits are often the only resource that is encouraging these investments and providing that stamp of approval that Wendy spoke about, letting folks know this is something they should do. I would note it's not in my written testimony, but we're also in conversation with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA is trying to deploy their loan dollars into rural parts of Oregon and around the country. We're in conversation with them about helping them do that. But tax credits to help low and moderate income families buy down the cost of the upgrade before they take out this loan is a really important tool to leverage against those USDA loans. So I hope that this tool stays available. Finally, I wanted to touch on energy efficiency work is not the same as solar work, as you all know. So I want to be careful as we're thinking about the sunsetting of solar-related tax credits, because that technology is maybe becoming super strong and in place, and in 6 years, maybe it won't be necessary to provide an incentive. Energy efficiency work is different from that, and I would just caution that we think carefully about the difference between those two as we think about the long-term horizon on this. The incentives in the energy efficiency space are motivating the next technology, and then the next technology, and then the next technology. So 15 years ago, we wouldn't have been talking about heat pump water heaters, but now we are. And then when that technology gets really good and gets widely adopted, we'll no longer need an incentive on it, but we'll need one on something else. So energy efficiency is an ongoing activity that needs this intelligent management. So overall, without the residential energy tax credit program, these smart investment multiplying benefits of energy and the benefits of energy savings and the job creation and the affordability and health benefits would be lost. So with our firsthand experience, we strongly at Inhabit, we strongly support continuation of the residential energy tax credit. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, the rest of the committee. I'm Mark Farrell. I'm with Neil Kelly Solar. Neil Kelly is a Oregon-based residential contractor, solar company, and home performance company. Tom Kelly has been interested in solar since the late 70s, and about 4 years ago or so in 2013, he saw the opportunity to purchase Mr. Sun Solar because John Patterson wanted to retire. And he said, well, this is a good time. We see stable incentives. We have great product, a great distribution, and we see the price going down over time. That was a really key issue for him because he says these incentives aren't going to be around forever. We understand that. Someone on the committee mentioned, well, you know, we have to – businesses plan. We do a lot of planning. I've been doing solar since 2010. At that time, I was installing solar for about $7 a watt. Right now, it's around $3.50 or less. So with the incentives, that's really helped us push the industry forward, get better products to tighten up our installation and to make sure that we're driving down that cost constantly. We hire all sorts of people. We've got electricians. We've got LRTs, limited renewable technicians doing solar. We've got people doing construction. We've got administrators. We've got a whole team of people that we've tripled since we bought Mr. Sun. We've also tripled our revenues, which is great. We see this incentive as key. It was mentioned earlier that the energy trust incentive has gone down. That was about $2 a watt when I started in 2010. Now it's at 35 cents. But the residential energy tax credit is also going down, which we think is fine. We get it. And we're looking at those curves. As that demand goes up, the price goes down. That's what we want. We want to see that gap. And we see that growing. The federal tax credit will also start sunsetting in 2020. So we've got all this planned out. And the one thing that we do see is for it to end at the end of this year would be a big problem. They would pretty much kill our business. So we're looking to ask you to extend residential energy tax credit so that we can continue building on solar in Oregon. And we also wanted to know that we understand as business people, Tom Kelly told me this specifically, so we understand that one of the key things is to we've got to get that budget taken care of. And he supports the work that's being done regarding the corporate tax issue. So, again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Different topic, but a welcome message. Questions for this panel? I'm interested, Mr. Farrell, does your company work in areas that are subject to the Energy Trust and also areas where it is not? And if so, can you tell us what the differences are in the uptake based on cost, if there is any?
Yes, we work in both areas. We have offices in Portland, Lake Oswego, Bend, and in Eugene. And what we have noticed is in some of the areas without the Energy Trust incentive, The uptake has actually increased a bit because the cost of solar has gone down and the Energy Trust Incentive hasn't been a make or break as it was in the past. But the residential energy tax credit is still key. Without that, then it becomes almost impossible because we aim for that 7 to 8 year payback. And suddenly without that, we're at like 15 plus, and that's very difficult for people to stomach, actually.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Robert Westerman, Sam Beeson, Peter Greenberg. Peter's here. A signature that begins Peter G. Scribble must be Peter Greenberg.
I can't even read my writing.
Gentlemen, please.
You guys go first.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairs Haas and Barnhart. My name is Robert Westerman. I serve as business manager for International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local Union 932. I represent journey-level electricians and apprentices along the Oregon coast. My geographical jurisdiction extends from Lincoln City to the California border. I'm here today to advocate for an extension of the RETC program. The program has created many job opportunities for my electricians on the Oregon coast. I recognize that many parts of Oregon have come back from the 2008 recession, but in some parts of rural Oregon, such as mine, we're still trying to get back to pre-2008 employment levels. The loss of the RETC program will have a direct and negative impact on workers and jobs in my jurisdiction. It will mean lost employment opportunities for my journeymen. It will mean lost training opportunities for my apprentices. And with those losses, it means the loss of wages, health and welfare benefits, and pension benefits for both journeymen and apprentices. I understand the competing interests for the state budget, but I ask that you prioritize programs like this that are proven job creation programs in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Yes, Sam Beeson with Mitsubishi Electric Heating and Cooling. We are a manufacturer of ductless heat pumps, so that's the component of the RETC that our company benefits from. And so I'm really here representing our distributor and our contractors throughout the state of Oregon. We work closely with the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance and other efficiency organizations, so we operate in the energy efficiency space. Our products are designed specifically as related to the incentive to go into homes that are heated all electrically now, typically with resistive heat. And our products provide an opportunity for the homeowner to have a dramatic increase in that energy efficiency component for their monthly utility bills. Typically on the western slopes here, the Cascades, it would be in the range of 300 to 500% increase in efficiency. So without the benefit of the RETC component, the payback, the ROI on that goes out quite a ways. So it's certainly benefited the growth of our industry and business development. So since 2008, we've had a great business opportunity for contractors to participate in because we're going into homes that have a heating system in there now that's not broken, so they could keep running it inefficiently for a long time. So it's created a business opportunity for HVAC contractors throughout the Pacific Northwest and specifically here in Oregon that have benefited in growth of either a new business or a new business opportunity for existing contractors to participate in this market. And according to the NEA statistics, up through 2014, in 6 years, there had been over 48,000 installations of ductless heat pumps that represented an efficiency component that would power 150,000 homes for a year. And we've seen continued growth in that, and we see our contractors continue to grow and expand and hire on. So we're very supportive of that, along with the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute, who sent a letter of support as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Greenberg.
Peter Greenberg. I've been in the energy business since the mid-'80s. And actually helped start the RETC program. It was an initiative petition initially, and that didn't quite make it, and the legislature started the next session. We used to make solar water heaters in Albany. In 1985, made about 1,600 of them, or maybe 10% that went into the state of Oregon over the years, with about $3 million in sales our first year. Reagan got in, got rid of the federal tax credit, the entire solar water industry went out of business overnight across the country. Solar's, we do mostly bigger solar stuff with the feed-in tariff program, but I certainly know about the residential business, and the panels have gotten a lot cheaper. There's a lot better economics of scale on bigger solar than smaller solar, just higher sales costs, and the inverters are more expensive, the racking's more for homes. But the $6,000 RETC in Western Oregon represents about 10 years of payback. And if you got rid of that, the solar PV, the residential systems, just overnight it would be gone. You know, there might be certainly room for a little lowering of it, but you know, the panel prices have come down a lot in the last couple of years. They might go down a little bit more, but they've come down really, they can't get below zero. Mm-hmm. Inverters have gotten cheaper, racking's gotten cheaper, and there's really just a lot more competition. The Energy Trust incentive used to be $2, it's 35 cents now. And looking at the numbers earlier, took a few notes, had some questions on the tax credits. There was, I think it said 1,967 tax credits last year. There was about 1,700 systems put into the Energy Trust, which is 92% of the state's population. I think other than Ashland, there's really no real incentives for consumers power. EWEB had programs, got rid of them, and so, you know, it would just eliminate very quickly any solar in any non-ETO area, and the ETO is really getting low enough that, you know, it really can't pick up the slack. The Energy Trust, 15% of their money goes towards renewables, and that's split between all types of renewables. And this year, I guess there was a lot more biopower, small hydro, or wind, or whatever, that took a lot of money away from solar, so the incentives have gotten down a lot faster this year than ever before. But
thank you. Thank you. Questions for this panel? I would simply note for Mr. Beeson that we heard from the mayor of Oak Ridge in the Energy and Environment Committee on their success with reducing air pollution in the area, partly by taking out inefficient and smoky wood stoves and replacing them with ductless heat pumps. And that was one use you hadn't mentioned, but we're not only dealing with efficiencies, but also breathable air. So that's a useful thing.
Yeah, thank you. Across the country, we're working with renewable energy and the electrification of thermal loads around the country in an effort to reduce carbon emissions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Jerry Ward, Hannah Cruz, please. Oh, Jay Ward. Sorry. Yes.
It is technically Jerry.
Okay. I just can't read an A versus an A and an R.
And I'm assuming I can, yeah. Okay. You're right here.
Yeah, but
no,
it's okay.
There.
They'll catch up.
Yep, they'll catch up.
All right.
Please go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Hannah Cruz with Energy Trust of Oregon. Energy Trust is a nonprofit organization. We serve about 1.6 million customers of Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural, Cascade Natural Gas, and Avista Gas. We serve nearly all of the state, but only in those service territories. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee today. Pursuant to our grant agreement with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, Energy Trust takes no position on the legislation before you, and we hope this information can help inform your deliberations. So with the Oregon Public Utility Commission and their guidance, Energy Trust is authorized to deliver cost-effective energy efficiency programs as well as small-scale renewable energy programs. And for homeowners, as you know during the discussion today, that's largely rooftop solar systems. Both of our energy efficiency and solar for homeowners, those programs interact with the Oregon Residential Energy Tax Credit and in different ways. I'll be covering the energy efficiency programs, and my colleague Jay Ward will be covering the solar program. On the energy efficiency side, our mandate is to save energy cost effectively, that is, at a lower cost than utilities would otherwise provide it for. To determine whether any one energy efficient improvement is cost effective, whether it's a heating system, a water heater, or a light bulb, we use the Oregon Public Utility Commission required cost effectiveness tests to ensure that the customer benefits outweigh the costs. In evaluating those costs, we often factor in other available incentives, and in this case, that can include the residential energy tax credit. Without the tax credit, the measure cost will increase, but since the benefits will remain the same, this will change the cost effectiveness score. Without the tax credit, efficiency improvements which are cost effective today and which can receive a cash incentive today, they may no longer pass the cost effectiveness test, in which case they would no longer qualify for an incentive from Energy Trust. Our initial analysis indicates the following six measures on this slide would most likely be impacted by the expiration of the residential energy tax credit, and those in bold would most likely be the most impacted. This slide shows a typical financing breakdown for a ductless heat pump, which is an increasingly popular improvement, particularly with moderate income homeowners. Ductless heat pumps are often used to replace inefficient electric baseboard heating in older homes and apartments. Taking a look at the cost that we've laid out here for you, the average ductless heat pump installation costs around $4,600. The state offers a maximum tax credit of $1,300, reducing the customer's cost to approximately $3,300. Energy Trust currently offers an incentive of $800, leaving the resident responsible for about $2,500. However, eliminating the tax credit is likely to significantly lower the cost effectiveness score for the ductless heat pump, and an Energy Trust incentive may no longer be available. Should the measure become non-cost effective, the cost to the homeowner would nearly double to $4,600. Should that occur, Energy Trust anticipates that the number of energy efficient improvements installed, such as ductless heat pumps, this example, that they would decrease. And in that case, more Oregonians would continue using less efficient and more energy intensive options, foregoing monthly energy and bill savings. Accurately predicting the decrease is complex. But we did a quick calculation that for next year, for 2018, we project ductless heat pump installations in the service territories that we serve to be approximately 2,200 units installed. However, if the increased cost to homeowners eliminated all ductless heat pump installations for the entire year, we would fail to acquire 5.5 million kilowatt hours of savings, which is about 4% of our projected savings for the entire residential sector. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague Jay Ward to describe the impacts on solar.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah.
Before we just a moment, Senator Riley.
I heard a little bit about the income level of people who use these ductless heat pumps. Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Of course. Chair Barnhart and Chair Haas and members of the committee, ductless heat pumps are an example of an improvement that are often replacing inefficient baseboard electric heaters. Those heaters are most often found in lower income households. And so in this case, a ductless heat pump is most often replacing that inefficient baseboard heating. We do offer, I mentioned, the $800 Energy Trust incentive. We're able to serve moderate income homeowners a little more robustly, and that incentive is around $1,000 to help cover that additional gap given their the lower income that they bring in. Does that answer your question?
Please,
And what area of the state is this available?
Yes, we'll show the service territory map. We cover just those five service territories of the utilities I mentioned: Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural, Cascade Natural Gas, and Avista. This is about nearly 100% of Oregon's natural gas customers and about 75-78% of Oregon's electricity customers. The rest, of course, being consumer-owned utility territory, Ashland, PUD, COUs, municipalities.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the big blank area is Representative Bent's district and Representative McLean's district.
And they're not here.
And they're not here. That's right.
We might point out, Senator Riley, that ductless heat pump is an electric measure, so it would not be. It would only be available in the mustard and green areas there.
Okay, thank you.
So,
as long as we're talking about ductless heat pumps, one comment and then a question. You're talking primarily about homes that don't have an existing usable ducted system. You would use a different heating system if you had ductwork already in the house, wouldn't you?
Correct.
The second question is, do you have any information on the payback period for these various different methods? If I'm paying $2,500 for one, what's my expected payback versus $4,600? I mean, obviously it's more, but it's less with a smaller dollar amount. Do you have any data on that you could provide us later?
Chair Barnhart, yes, we do have that data. I don't have that data in front of me at this moment, but we can follow up with you and provide that.
We've heard a bunch of testimony already about payback on solar, and this would be, I think, useful.
And I'd like
additional
to see that
data
as well.
So yeah, if you send it to the committee administrator, Chris Alanak or LRO itself, that would be very helpful, and we'll see that it gets in the record. Thank you. Please go ahead on the solar.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Jay Ward, Energy Trust of Oregon. Hannah's presentation covered our efficiency programs, which constitutes the vast majority of our work. I'll take a minute to talk about our smaller slice that makes up our renewable program. Within our renewable sector, Energy Trust provides incentives for residential solar projects as part of our larger goal of creating a vigorous and sustainable market for solar in Oregon, one that will ultimately thrive without incentives. And our solar program is designed around incentives that are managed in response to market behaviors and are capped at above market cost. That's in contrast with the cost effectiveness test that Hannah detailed earlier. Above market cost is defined as the difference between the total cost of the project and the value of power that it generates over the life of the project. We also create and enforce quality standards, and we aid the industry to drive down soft costs, and we ensure a robust and qualified installer base. At present, there are 55 active residential solar trade ally companies in Energy Trust service territory. Since 2002, with Energy Trust support, those trade allies have installed over 10,000 residential solar systems, including 1,640 in 2016. Those systems combined generate enough annual energy to fully power about half of the homes that put them up. In comparing the zip codes of tax credit recipients and the addresses of Energy Trust customers, we have concluded that nearly all those receiving an Energy Trust residential solar incentive also avail themselves of the residential energy tax credit. And as you may have heard, solar power costs have gone down over time, and the number of residential systems installed each year has increased, as has the size of the systems being installed. So these changes are reflected in the incentives that Energy Trust and the Residential Energy Tax Credit have provided to homeowners. I will note here that this particular slide was put together for the House Energy and Environment Committee in March, and as has been noted earlier, we have reduced our incentives since that time from the 57 cents a watt that you see depicted here.
Was it higher in 2015?
I believe so. I actually used to have a slide that had a graph, but I cut it out because of time.
The reason I ask is because 16, and the slide before 16 seems to be lower than 15.
Well, that's the number of systems that were done.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Please go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. My pleasure. So in 2016, the average size of a residential solar system was 6 kilowatts. Trade allies sold these systems for an average of $3.81 a kilowatt, and the average total system cost was approximately $23,000 before the Residential Energy Tax Credit and Energy Trust incentives were applied. Over time, the state-managed Residential Energy Tax Credit program has made periodic adjustments to the amount of funding, as you've heard earlier. And I should note also that while this shows 99 cents a watt average for the Residential Energy Tax Credit, that is averaged out over a 6-kilowatt system. It actually is $1.30, if I'm not mistaken, and I think our friends at the Department of Energy can probably verify that. By the way, it should be noted that we talked about the declining price of solar, and that's true in some markets but not all markets. We tend to think of markets as geographic, but they're also economic. So utility scale solar, something that our Portland General Electric or Pacific Power would build, there are almost no above market costs at that level. At the commercial scale, there are still above market costs, and within the residential market, especially at the lower end, there are significant barriers to adoption. The changes over time to both system cost and the residential energy tax credit have reduced the above, remaining above-market costs for which Energy Trust can provide an incentive. So Energy Trust reduced its residential solar incentives as well to ensure that we're not paying for more than we need to. And if there's above-market costs, we will pay it. If there's not, we don't. There's another reason you've heard that we are reducing our incentives to the We have a fixed budget, as has been noted, about 15% of the public purpose charges authorized in Senate Bill 1149. For this year, that's about $14.4 million, and that covers five renewable energy technologies from solar, hydro, bio, wind, and geo. So it's been a very popular year for solar power, and a lot of customers adopting it, and they are we're trying not to run out of money. So we've had to reduce our incentives to make sure that there's something at the end of the year. So future solar cost decreases are not guaranteed, however. Late last month, the United States International Trade Commission took up a complaint asserting that a flood of imports had put a once strong domestic solar manufacturing industry on its last legs. Domestic manufacturers asking for import duties of 40 cents per watt to be levied on all solar cells produced outside the U.S. That would effectively double the price of solar cells and, not surprisingly, increase above market cost. So what will happen if the tax credit expires as scheduled? Assuming no change in the price of solar cells without the tax credit, the total remaining above market costs would increase. If Energy Trust raises its incentive to cover more of the above market cost, it would significantly reduce the number of systems we could support. If the customer has to cover the increase themselves, we would expect fewer homeowners to move forward with installations. In either case, for Energy Trust to increase incentives or for the homeowners to pay more without other changes in the market, Energy Trust would expect to see a reduction in the total number of projects installed each year. And if fewer projects are being installed, we would expect to see our trade ally contractors leave the market before the volume of business, because the volume of business would go down. And this assessment is based on market contractions, which other states have experienced when they reduced or eliminated solar tax credits or other incentives. In Louisiana, as this chart indicates, the end of the state tax credit for solar at the end of 2015 led to a sharp decline in solar installations. Similar results have occurred in other states as well. Thank you for the opportunity to provide our context, and we'd be happy to answer any questions should you have any.
Thank you so much. Any brief questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Our last panel today, Michael Kaplan, Marcia Kelly, please. Mr. Kaplan, thank you for waiting.
My pleasure. Good afternoon. For the record, Michael Kaplan, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. I am in the ironic and unenviable position of testifying in opposition to the extension of the residential energy tax credit. This is a position that our department has long held, articulated repeatedly, and is following the governor's directive issued to legislative leadership last year. I want to unequivocally state that I do believe that the value of the industries and the jobs and the outcomes of the RETC are incredibly valuable to the state of Oregon. The incentive does provide positive changes for our state. The promotion of energy efficiency and the implementation of renewable energy devices are more important with each passing day. However, it can simultaneously be true that a program, no matter how well-intentioned, can become antiquated, require significant reinvestment, rethinking, and a necessary overhaul. We have learned repeatedly at the Oregon Department of Energy that we did not manage our responsibilities as it relates to incentive programs very well at all for a very long period of time. We've been working for years to climb out of a hole that we dug ourselves with the management of our incentive programs. The RETC has not been specifically implicated in many of the larger problems that have captured the public's attention as it relates to the Department of Energy's tax credits, but the absence of criticism should not convey a clean bill of health. If I felt the program were retrievable with simple changes, we certainly would have proposed them. The data that we have at the department is unreliable. We require significant IT investments to build the sophisticated systems we need. We do not have a clawback mechanism. We do not have sufficient compliance resources. We lack fee authority for RETC, and the audits and examinations of other tax credit programs throughout the agency all point to systemic problems that did also impact RETC. We've been forthcoming about these problems in every venue available to us, including to the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee that met throughout 2016. To move forward, I believe we should make strategic decisions about what our incentives should accomplish together as a state so that clear expectations are set for the public, our stakeholders in this body. Is RETC an economic development program? Is it an energy efficiency program? Or is it a renewable energy program or a greenhouse gas reduction program? The answers to those fundamental questions will be a lesson learned from the BETC program, for example, and some of the other tax credit programs that we've run at the department. Without clear goals, trackable metrics, sufficient compliance resources, and the sophisticated systems we need to track data, we're bound to repeat mistakes of the past. The effectiveness and legitimacy of every ODO program has been compromised by its struggles with incentive programs. There is a place in state government for these types of investments. We should lead. We should help Oregon contribute to our energy and climate goals. However, rather than continuing a program that has run for close to 40 years, I would strongly urge you to give us the opportunity, to give the state an opportunity to start anew. I appreciate your time. I apologize that I cannot be here to give a full-throated support of this program, and I know that I've disappointed valuable partners that we have throughout Oregon, not to mention perhaps you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Would you submit what you've just read to the for the record? It contains a number of suggestions, which I think we ought to pay attention to.
Chair Barnhart just typed out this morning, but I'd be happy to get it to you later this evening.
A clean copy. Thank
you. Yes, sir.
Appreciate it. Ms. Kelly, please.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, members of the committee who are still here. My name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We're not against the environment. We're not against sustainable efforts. We just don't think that the RETC deserves tax dollars at the cost of education, human services, and public safety. We saw the chart that the Oregon Department of Energy provided with the average cost of the tax credits and the credits issued. I went further and multiplied that for the year and then multiplied it for a potential two-year time frame. Because of what Mr. Alanak discussed about lower income people not taking advantage of the credits, there is a disconnect about how many credits were actually certified for and about how many credits are actually achieved. But it could be a pretty hefty bill if more people actually use the credits that have been certified. One of the concerns in the proposed amendment in the bill, 2681A, is you talk about getting demographic information about who is using the credits. A look at the 2014 tax expenditure report gives you a pretty good idea. 8,280 filers in the top 20% used the credit. 8,150 in the other four tiers used the credit. And there were only 1,500 under 27,600 in income who were able to use the credit. So it looks like we're incentivizing those people who most likely, like our household, could afford to put solar panels or ductless heat pumps in to a great extent. Because about $8 million of the credit in 2014 was used by that top 20%, and it's the credit cost was approximately $13 million. So it looks like more of the money is going to higher incomes than achieving necessarily just getting us green and sustainable. In looking for information, because I'd heard the rumor that in Washington, you know, everybody disappeared, and I'd heard Washington had a 20% decline in their solar industry, I bashed around and tried to find something, and I did find something from solarpowerrocks.com, which looks at states and their uses of the credit. And Oregon has good news. Oregon is number four in 2016, according to Solar Power Rocks. We get an A for our tax incentive. But I would point out that of the top nine who get an A qualification for Solar Power Rocks, of states and the District of Columbia that five states had an F for a state tax credit incentive. One had a D and one had a C. Only one state, New York, had an A for a tax incentive, and that was New York. And they also have a very high incentive. And also trying to find one table that says what the tax incentive is in states, it's very difficult to find that information. But the majority of the states that I could find that had a tax credit incentive caps it at $1,000 and not at $5,000 or $6,000. We think that continuing the residential energy tax credit should either be what your joint interim committee on the Department of Energy oversight suggests, and that's extending it only 2 years to until they get a handle on it, or I would most likely think that you could very easily end it. It could become even more costly as more people go out and do the solar installations and the ductless heat pumps, again, mostly benefiting the top 20% of Oregonians. I understand the encouragement of jobs, but jobs will be there for the folks of the 20% who are doing these installations anyway. And the low-income Oregonians are not necessarily going to benefit. They could benefit more likely from help with their daycare. That's on the chopping block. Better education for their kids. We know where we're going with that. Or more robust public safety for all of us.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you. A question for Mr. Kaplan. I appreciate what I interpret as an expressed desire to sort of give the Department of Energy a clean slate in terms of moving forward and setting aside some of the areas that have been problematic. We've also heard testimony today about how even a pause in the solar incentive programs in other states have created chaos and a significant decline. Can you imagine a bridge program that gets us from where we are today to the point where we can perhaps address some of the problems that you've identified? Is that a two-year extension of the program? Is that something completely different?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Marsh, I think to give you a comprehensive answer, we'd be here for about a half an hour because I've spent far too much time thinking about tax credits. I will say that the problems in these programs are not unsolvable. I certainly don't believe that it's a bridge too far that the state can't solve. However, I think there are fundamental questions that we have to answer, and very quickly. We're a Department of Energy. Distributing tax credits is a very different skill set. Dealing with the kinds of statutory authority you need when you're dealing with income tax, particularly, is also is difficult, as well as if we get into questions, and it was a routine question of Representative Bentz in the 2015 session about return on investment. Ideally, you're having your incentives create either achieve a goal or create momentum in which you build on and create more incentives, and you're constantly moving forward. I do think that it is possible to create a bridge program. I think that we are very short on time. The governor, her position, and I appreciate it, was somewhat what you indicated, was let these programs end. Let's have a conversation about how to do them better, because the state does have a responsibility to make these incentives. I think we could absolutely do it. Can we do it in 27 days? I think that would be a little bit of a challenge. If we're comfortable advancing or potentially moving to the RETC to another agency and then giving them the responsibility to work on it in consultation with us, that's also certainly an option in your purview. I think one of the issues that we've run into is that the credibility that the Department of Energy has to work on these programs, to work on incentive programs, has been constrained, if not totally evaporated. So there are a number of moving parts, and I said I wouldn't talk to you for a half an hour, but I can feel myself on that path. So do I think it's possible? Absolutely. Do I think there are significant constraints? Yes.
Well, I would like to see, I guess, that half an hour of testimony in writing somehow so that we have to see if we have a path forward here.
Thank you. That's why I asked for what he was reading from, because it listed a bunch of issues that should be dealt with. Let me say that I really appreciate the work that you have done in trying to deal with the many problems the department's had that you had nothing to do with creating. And you've been extremely cooperative and helpful as we've talked about this and other issues during the last couple of years. And I'm also very appreciative of the realization that this department is not the one that's best suited to handle a myriad of small transactions, even if you might end up being a department that ends up helping with the guidelines for when it would be offered. Other departments that have actually worked with many small transactions on a regular basis have been suggested as a possible repository for the business end of this of these credits.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, if there's anything I've learned from sort of wrestling with these programs, is that agencies should focus on what agencies do very well. And in our case, I would put us up, our energy expertise, I'd put up against anyone. Mm-hmm. Our financial expertise, I think that there are agencies better suited to handle those responsibilities. So being able to design programs that both recognize that and accommodate that, I think lead to more successful, more justifiable programs. So I think I'm exactly in line with what you're suggesting.
Thank you. Better than Illinois, but not as good as you need to be.
I put Oregon up against everyone.
Not required to answer that question. Thank you. I appreciate it. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate the testimony today and people being willing to stay late in order to get it all in. And with that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2681 and Senate Bill 177, and the committee is adjourned. 77, and the committee is adjourned.